From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1988, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson was a longtime viola player and an emerging singer with an affinity for experimental music and a powerful, emotive voice. When her viola was stolen over Thanksgiving weekend that year, she was devastated but took it as a sign. The vocal career was the right way. In the years since, Hunt Lieberson's star has soared. The luminous mezzo-soprano has been lauded for the most potent voice since Maria Callas. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson has sung in two productions at the Met, John Harbison's The Great Gatsby, and Berlioz's The Trojans last season. She's been praised as the finest Carmen of our time and was named Vocalist of the Year by Musical America in 2001. She's also been called an arch-maverick in the rarefied world of opera and concert song. She handpicks roles that suit her emotions as well as her voice and frequently works with small experimental groups, directors, and conductors. And yes, she once lived on the grounds of a Mexican prison. Critics' praise for Hunt Lieberson's work climbs quickly and often into the ecstatic, rapt, erotic, fierce, profound, overwhelming. Tonight on Point, the mezzo-soprano marvel, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. Joining me now from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, mezzo-soprano recitalist, concert singer, and operatic performer. Her recent CD of the Bach cantatas, performed with Boston's Orchestra of Emmanuel Music, has been widely praised and topped a number of best-of charts in 2003. Good evening and welcome, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson.
Thank you. Happy to be here on the phone.
It's wonderful to have you from beautiful Santa Fe, and we're looking forward to spending an hour with you and your music. I'm going to just start out by asking you what you make of the hurricane of comparisons and praise that has come at you in the last couple of years. It's kind of overwhelming, I would think, to be in your shoes. What do you make of it? We just quoted The New Yorker here in the top of our introduction, comparing you with Maria Callas. There's been just plaudit after plaudit heaped. How does it feel?
Well, honestly, when you said the word overwhelming, the first thing I thought of was the pile of stuff on my desk that I need to attend to.
The paperwork, the junk.
So I guess I have to say that the praise and the response to the record and other things in the last years is, you know, not so hard to take as far as...
Feels good.
I mean, I appreciate it greatly. As I said, it's my desk that is more overwhelming and my sort of daily life, you know, just trying to stay organized and be on top of things, that's more overwhelming. But, no, it's wonderful. It is true when somebody says, compares me to Callas,
the most potent voice since.
Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, you know, I step back a bit and say, well, gee, thanks. But, of course, I do my own comparison because we're not the same singer at all. And for people that may not know me, then if they expect me to sound like Callas, right, it's not going to sound like Callas because I'm not a soprano, for one thing, which she was. And, you know, we don't have the same voice. I think what they're referring to is, you know, a kind of intensity, perhaps, that infuses much of what I do and my intent and just my natural tendency.
Tendency, a very mild word. I mean, the critics just swoon rapturously for the intensity that you bring to the recital hall or to the stage. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, we will have listeners who know you and your work very well and the world that you sing in very well. We'll have others that don't. Would you be good enough to just map it out here? You're a mezzo-soprano. What does that mean in terms of voice? What does it mean in terms of the kind of roles that are there for a singer in that tier?
Well, the mezzo-soprano is lower voice than the soprano being the highest voice, then it's mezzo-soprano, then you have tenor for the men of the high voices, and then baritone, and then bass. I started out as a kind of a, I don't know what I'd call myself, a low soprano. I started out with a lighter, higher sitting voice, and then as I've matured, it's filled out, it's become richer, and it's also sort of lower and deeper in timbre, I guess you could say. The kind of roles, I mean, there's quite a wide range, because as in the soprano category or in any other category, the mezzo-soprano category, there are different types. You have a lyric mezzo, which would be a lighter, higher, and then you have heavier, more dramatic roles. Maybe the lyric mezzo roles that would be very well known to people would be Cherubino and Marriage of Figaro. The mezzo-soprano takes on most of what they call pants roles, or they used to call trouser roles.
That is, playing a man.
Yes, usually a young man or a boy.
Right.
And then there's roles like Carmen, which is probably maybe the most universally famous mezzo-soprano role. And I've sort of, you know, lived in both those worlds at different times of my career. I did a Cherubino years ago, and some other pants roles in Handel operas, Sesto in Julius Caesar.
Yeah, famously a Sesto in Julius Caesar. You know, I'd like to go back with some music for just a minute, all the way back to 1986, when you had just begun to emerge as a vocalist from your viola career. We've got a recording here that you did with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Chanson de Mélisande. Let's listen to a bit of this, and maybe you can tell us before we do what we're going to hear and what we should listen for.
First of all, I should make it clear, since I just did a concert version of Debussy's opera, Pélias et Mélisande, this is not the opera. This was a song that was discovered. The BSO was recording the famous Fauré Pélias et Mélisande suite.
This is the so-called incidental music by Fauré.
Yes, which the famous tune that the flute plays in that suite is da 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 da. Some of you may recognize that. And then a song was discovered that had been written originally for the Maeterlinck play. And it was for a production that was being done in London. So the song was originally written in English, oddly enough, by Fauré. So this is the song that, in the play, Mélisande sang from her balcony as she was brushing her long hair.
Let's hear it. This is from 1986. You'll hear the evolution in this voice over time. Here it is, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, 86. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, you've made a lot of recordings and had a lot of performances since this one in 1986. When you listen back now, what do you hear? Is this a different voice? Is it a different person or consistent?
Well, it sounds like me. It just sounds like a younger me. And especially some of my early Handel recordings, I really noticed such a lighter, more youthful sound. And I also enviously noticed that I can move my voice quicker back then, too.
Every singer has to understand time. You're something near 50 now?
I'm just about to turn 50 March 1st, and so, I mean, it's really a wonderful thing to be a singer because, I mean, here at 50, I can still feel like I'm in my prime, which is pretty nice.
It's a terrific thing. You're famous for picking your roles with great care. What do you look for when you're looking for a role, a piece of music to sing?
Well, I have to say, this also kind of makes me think back to my early days of just kind of being aware of what I really liked and what I didn't care for in music or art. And I remember I grew up with the Beatles, and so I kind of missed Bob Dylan, and Elvis was also kind of before the time when I really got into popular music.
Yeah.
And I realized I didn't appreciate Bob Dylan because I didn't like the sound of his voice.
Simple as that.
And I couldn't get past that in order to, of course now I appreciate what he was all about, and of course the words were so important. But for me, I think the music and the sound was much more prominently affecting.
And it wasn't that you were dead set against pop music. You used to have a lounge act, and you played Chicago, Joni Mitchell, Stevie Wonder. So it wasn't
I've always loved that music and sung it whenever I could. But, yeah, I'm just sort of looking at how the music will really hit me first, although then the content of the text needs to also be important to me, too, you know, now. But initially, the sound of the music and the way that affects me is pretty much primary. But, you know, if the text is fabulous and the music is no good, I don't think I could really be too drawn to it. I mean, I could enjoy the text for itself,
but the music needs to be there. You're also well known for taking the emotion, the coloring of the music to enormous heights and depths. Do you have to feel that potential when you sit and look at the text itself? Is it the text or the music that alerts you to whether or not this is an emotional path that you can follow?
Well, like I say, at this point, it's really both. So I can be, if it's a new piece, I could be excited about the text, and then if the music isn't really, you know, doesn't do it for me, then that doesn't really work. So they both really need to come together these days, and I, you know, fortunately there's plenty of stuff out there.
It's a great position to be in. We're talking tonight with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. Behind us here, from the Bach Cantata 82, another aria, Schlummert ein ihr matten Augen. We'll hear a lot more after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with mezzo-soprano recitalist, concert singer, and operatic performer Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. In the background is an aria from the Bach Cantata No. 82. It's Ich freue mich auf meinen Tod, or I delight in my death. A recent CD of Bach cantatas was on top 10 lists right across the country. We had to scour the city to find a copy of ourselves. It is popular. It sells out all over the place. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson joins us tonight from Santa Fe, New Mexico. So give us the calculus, Lorraine. How did you come to want to do these?
Well, I have a long history and wonderful relationship with Emmanuel Music of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Smith is the conductor. And when I first moved to Boston in 1980, I came to Boston as a violist. I'd already been pursuing my freelance career as a violist, and I came with the intention of starting to study voice again. I had been a double major in college.
Mm-hmm.
So I first started playing viola in the Emmanuel Orchestra. And they had been playing Bach cantatas as part of the church service at Emmanuel Church for years, just as in Bach's day, where every Sunday he had to churn out a cantata.
Something new, something fresh.
Yeah. So that was a wonderful experience to, you know, come to a new town and to join in with this wonderful group and such a rich body of work. And then within a couple, 3 years, I switched over and joined the choir. It was like a small choir, small chamber orchestra, and everybody was professional. It was all, everybody got paid, so it was a wonderful little side job and a fantastic musical experience for all of us back then.
And 20 years later, back to the Bach cantata again.
I've done, continued to do things with them over the years, and this is our latest, these two Bach cantatas. And it came out of a project with Peter Sellers directing, and we decided to stage these two Bach cantatas, cantata 82, Ich habe genug, and cantata 199, Mein Herz schwimmt in Blut.
My heart swims in blood, lovely.
Yeah, it can't get more dramatic than that.
No, it can't. Lorraine, I want to welcome into our conversation, if I could, Craig Smith. He joins us from Boston. He's artistic director of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music. Welcome, Craig Smith.
Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly.
Craig, we're wrestling with the enormous popularity and ecstatic kind of descriptions of the singing of Lorraine Hunt Lieberson tonight. I'd love it if you'd share with us, as artistic director, your impression, your understanding, your characterization of this great mezzo-soprano's work. What is it that gets people so on fire about Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's singing?
Well, I think that probably the first thing is that the intensity is, and the incredible sort of laser-like intensity that she brings to her work is perhaps the first thing, but I think as her musician friends here in Boston, and I think all over the country, also after that initial sort of shock, are most just appreciate the incredible level of musical sophistication and musical intention that she brings to her projects. That the Bach project, for instance, came out of, I mean, we had done many cantatas together, and Peter, I think, heard many of these cantatas and realized that, particularly when delivered the way Lorraine does, that they bring a kind of dramatic intensity that really most opera doesn't. And so that he said, why not put them on the stage? And I think that it was a wonderful idea, and it really worked terribly well. It's interesting. Lorraine, I don't know how you feel about it, but when I listen to our recording, I can't help but see our staging. I mean, they're so, in my mind, tied together.
Paint the picture of that staging for us, if you would.
Lorraine was, for the cantata 199, she was in this very beautiful, rather sort of medieval-looking robe. I mean, I think, in fact, it was patterned after something that the designer saw in Paris in a museum. And she is just this robe which she entangles herself in the flaps of
ashes,
the robe.
Yeah.
Right, and then the second cantata is completely different. She's in a hospital, Johnny.
And this is for Isha Begenuch.
Yes, and she is, I think, Lorraine, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I think it's supposed to be the last hour of her life.
Yeah, the last half hour.
And
this is of Mary's life, is that right?
It feels like an hour. but it is, and it's in that respect just, you know, incredibly striking that, you know, this adventure and this journey of what our end will be like is somehow brought to life. And it's just, you know, and obviously Bach, that is what Bach is exploring. And so I think that I know that an awful lot of people that knew Bach cantatas were just overwhelmed by the performance. It just brought a new element.
I want to listen to some of Ich habe genug. Craig Smith, set this up for us. Is there a story being told here?
Well, not exactly a narrative. There is a biblical passage that is a background to it, which is, it's the story of Saint Simeon, the old man, and Jesus is brought into the temple, and he sees Jesus and says, "Now I."
So Jesus is a very young child.
Right, and he says, he's the first one to recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And he says, "Now I can depart. Now I can die. That I realize that the Messiah has come." And so that Ich habe genug is really the death throes of Saint Simeon.
Let's listen to Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing Ich habe genug from Bach Cantata 82. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing Ich habe genug from Bach Cantata 82. Craig Smith, Artistic Director of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music, is with us, and Lorraine Hunt Lieberson.
And I have to say, we must give so much credit to Peggy Pearson.
Peggy Pearson, the oboist. Unbelievable oboe. Also overwhelming, and credit given and very much due. But connect us with your process here. Craig Smith told us the kind of narrative story that lies behind this. As a singer, how do you connect with the emotion that you're going to bring to the song? How do you identify it? What do you visualize? How do you generate it? Can you share that with us?
Well, it doesn't feel like I have to do much, I have to say, to conjure it up. It's all there.
Do you put yourself in the mind of this little bit of story that surrounds this music, of an old man, you know, meeting a child that he recognizes as the Messiah? Are you working from the narrative power there, or is it simply straight from the music that you work emotionally?
Well, the text is rich, and the music is, I mean, I hate to sort of, and I'm not the kind of analytical person too much, but I was thinking about Bach, and of course, the genius is, you know, recognized. But you know, I was thinking, well, what makes it, you know, so amazing? I'm sure Craig has some things, but for me, one thing I thought of and that I appreciate in a great composer is not only is there just incredible genius of intellectual prowess and the music on a technical level is just astounding, but then the heart, the sort of soul quality in the music is just as prominent. And when that is, you know, it's like yin and yang, the, you know, feminine and masculine energy together, and then you just have pure alchemy and magic, I think. And so the music and the text together here is enough to, you know, completely inspire me. I don't have to, you know, have a, and then with Peter, with the fantastic orchestra and Craig, and then Peter Sellers staging this so that it's even more kind of direct and real and in the present. It's not, you know, this old piece that was written so many years ago and based on, it's something real where it's the last half hour of somebody's death, and I'm living that. You know, I mean,
yes.
It's very rich and very inspiring.
Yeah, well, it's very rich and inspiring to listen to. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Craig Smith, I wonder, you've worked with many singers. You've known Lorraine Hunt Lieberson for a long time. You see her working through these songs in rehearsal over weeks and months, I assume, getting ready to do this. How do you explain the intensity that she brings?
Well, I think that her process is really good. I mean, I know that sounds like a rather kind of dry way to describe it, but all of this would be phony if it weren't grounded in the fact that Bach is there and that Bach's ideas, I mean, and certainly Bach as a composer, he had this absolutely raging need to communicate very profound things with his audience. And Lorraine really understands that. And so that her process, rather than kind of wanting to show herself off or whatever, the many kind of reasons why anyone would be a performer, her process is absolutely genuine. And I think that that shows in a moment. I think that the audience, and certainly her colleagues, but also even the audience, can absolutely tell that this is a genuine process and a genuine something very authentic.
Lorraine, Drew Minter has described you coming off stage in tears after an operatic performance. Is it the identification, the involvement in the music that deep? Are you not only technically and physically spent, but emotionally spent when you finish a particularly intense performance?
Sometimes, yes. I can't remember whether that quote. I know. I think Peggy, maybe, in fact, when we did Julius Caesar.
Oh, you're right. That's right. It's Peggy Pearson talking
Peggy.
About Julius Caesar. That's absolutely
it was,
right.
Actually, I remember because it wasn't the end of the opera. It was the end of the first act, which has probably the most beautiful duet ever written.
And this is a pants role, as you described. You're playing Sesto,
yes.
the vengeance riven son of Pompey and Julius Caesar.
Right, and it's a duet with Sesto and Cornelia, who is Sesto's mother, and they have just sort of been seen their husbands, her husband and his father's head been delivered, Pompey's head been delivered, you know, literally on a platter, practically, and now they're being separated, and Sesto is being, and they're both being imprisoned. So this is a duet of farewell and possibly forever farewell, and it's so heart-wrenching, and I mean, it was difficult not to cry during the piece, frankly.
Let me ask you again there for me, because since most of us trace and root our emotions in narrative, but a musician like yourself can root it directly in the music, but an opera is such a blend of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the story or the music?
It makes it doubly potent, then, if they're both a true and strong combination.
I think that's exactly it. I want to listen to a bit more from your most recent CD of Bach cantatas. This is Mein Herz schwimmt in Blut, My Heart Swims in Blood. We'll come back and talk about it after the break, but let's hear a good stretch. We're talking tonight with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt-Lieberson. Craig Smith, Artistic Director of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music, is with us as well. Here from Bach Cantata 199, Mein Herz schwimmt in Blut. Talking tonight with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt-Lieberson, recitalist, concert singer, and opera performer. You're listening to her performing My Heart Swims in Blood from Bach Cantata 199. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt-Lieberson. We're also joined by Craig Smith, Artistic Director of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music in Boston. Behind us, you heard it before the break, and it's here again, My Heart Swims in Blood from the Bach Cantata 199. Craig Smith, tell us about the background to this piece. What is Bach writing to here?
Well, this is really one of his most operatic and intense pieces. And in fact, that segment that we just heard is really purely one of the most sort of purely operatic things that he ever wrote, and so that it invites the kind of intensity that Lorraine brings to it. It is the most extreme form of kind of self-flagellating Christianity that there is. I know of, there's no other piece quite like this in Bach. It's so extreme. And I think it invites a kind of extreme reaction from the performers.
And we hear it very movingly, in moments almost threateningly, Lorraine, not so much in your voice, but in the intensity of the message here. The 90s were a time when you dealt with some difficulty in your own life, your sister's death, your own breast cancer. Does personal biography come in flow in to the delivery of a song like this one?
Well, it's all in there somewhere. But that sort of chapter of, you know, health issues and my sister was, you know, more connected to the Cantata 82, Ich habe genug. But, yeah, Mein Herz schwimmt im Blut, it's like the dark night of the soul. So I'm sure we've all had those. So it when you have a vehicle like this, then, you know, I don't, for example, have specific memories as I perform this piece of my own history, but it's all, you know, feelings that we may relate to in some way or another, and maybe not specifically in this, you know, exactly as this text is, but it, you know, just even those first words, my heart swims in blood, since the offspring of my sins in the holy eyes of God make me a monster. And now my conscience feels pain. For me, my sins can be nothing but the hangmen of hell. And there was also, Craig, I don't know, maybe you can say something about the, you know, the story behind this, because then she goes on to say, oh, hated night of depravity and well, the evil seed of Adam. So,
The one thing that I would say is that I think about the issue of our is that our personal histories, of course, are going to enter into the way we perform. I mean that there is that we are the sum of our history, and so that it's obvious with somebody like Lorraine that what she brings to it is really almost unconscious and folded into her life, and that obviously the trials and tribulations of one's life certainly come out in a piece like this. But I think it's very seldom that where you can just sort of directly say, oh, that reminds me of this, because there is this sort of element of abstraction.
Yeah.
Right.
No question. And yet, I mean, we look at your story, Lorraine, and you've got in your delivery a kind of capacity for abandon, very disciplined but yet abandoned, but also in your life, I mean, years ago, moving to a Mexican prison grounds to be near a boyfriend who was there, there seems to be something consistent in this character that's willing to go way out there on a limb following passion.
Well, I do think there's certainly a part of me that likes the edge and wants to go there. And this is one of those pieces. This is one of those moments in somebody's life, or that we may have all experienced, where you're just at the edge of despair and complete hopelessness, and so full of self-hatred. You know, it's a fantastic way to kind of express all of that. And you know, people, I think, are moved, because they know what that feels like. And then to see it on a stage, or to hear it sort of larger than life, you know, it's kind of has a potent effect, or can.
To say the least, it can and does. Craig Smith.
I just think also that, I mean, that really is what is demanded of the performer, that they have to have this incredible kind of disciplined skeleton to the way they work, and yet they are asked to go out on the edge and be and just really go for it. And that's one of the things that we all love about Lorraine, is that she just will absolutely risk everything.
Well,
which is something that is, you know, not very many performers have, but it is something that the music really does in some way demand.
It calls out for it, and we hear it in every song. It's a wonderful thing. Craig Smith, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. It's been great having you. Craig Smith, Artistic Director of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music. And Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, thank you so much for your song and for sharing a little bit with us about how you come to deliver it. It's been great. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Behind us, from Bach Cantata 199, For God Must Be Gracious to Me, sung by mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Mein
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The message rings out loud and clear. Americans are voting for change. East and West, North, and now in the South.
Today, I end my campaign for the presidency. But our party's campaign to change America is really, it's just beginning. And folks, this old soldier will not fade away.
The strain of avian influenza detected in the one flock is not harmful to human beings. That makes it very different than the strain that caused the deaths in Asia.
People asked for records to be released that would demonstrate he met his requirements. The records have now been fully released.
The 40 nations of the Nuclear Suppliers Group should refuse to sell enrichment and reprocessing equipment and technologies to any state that does not already possess full-scale, functioning enrichment and reprocessing plants.
Once again, British Airways is canceling some flights because of security alerts. The latest is BA's 223 to Washington Dulles on Sunday. Monday's flight 263 to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, has also been scrapped.
Any monkey looking down from Mars on Earth knows that the countries in NATO and North America are the bulk of the countries on the face of the Earth that have the same values, the same lack of a desire to impose their will on somebody else and take their real estate and seize it. We don't do that.
A suicide car bomber drove into the street where a number of new Iraqi army recruits were waiting on the road when the bomb detonated.
How will history judge us if we, for the first time, change our Constitution for the sole purpose of discrimination?
I deserve a mom and dad. I deserve a mom and dad.
The Supreme Judicial Court can and does indeed invoke the laws of man. But the Supreme Judicial Court cannot repeal the law of nature.
Jared T. Barrios. No. Frederick E. Berry. No. Stephen M. Brewer. Yes. Harriet L. Chandler. No.
And there's a week. John Kerry speaks after his Democratic primary sweeps in Tennessee and Virginia Tuesday. General Clark bows out of the primary race after losses in the South on Tuesday. Clark endorsed John Kerry today in Wisconsin. The avian flu hit chicken flocks in Delaware and has spread to neighboring states. White House spokesman Scott McClellan released more records of President Bush's service in the Air National Guard. President Bush announces a new plan to curb nuclear proliferation in a speech Wednesday in Washington. British Airways grounded two flights Sunday and Monday, citing a terrorist threat. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld speaks after a meeting Saturday with Germany's Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer at a defense conference in Munich, citing a monkey on Mars. More than 100 Iraqis died in back-to-back suicide bombings Tuesday and Wednesday, and Massachusetts legislators debated but failed to deliver a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. Jack Beatty, a lot on the stovetop this week.
Yes, and the departure of General Wesley Clark. He gave up his bid for the presidency earlier in the week and today endorsed John Kerry. You know, when you look at General Clark's run, it brings home this isn't kid stuff. You got to know what you're doing in politics. And for all his brilliance, he just made all sorts of mistakes. I mean, within 24 hours of entering the race, in an unguarded and impolitic interview with the New York Times, he took, I think, three positions on the Iraq war simultaneously.
It is a striking thing. Everyone says, you know, we want someone from outside here. This was an outsider, but with a lot of experience. And yet there was a kind of naivete that seemed to float around him early on.
There really was, and his stock in trade was, I can be Howard Dean. I was right about the war, so far as Democrats see it, but I don't have Howard Dean's liability, so I can carry that fight. But then within, he starts to sort of impeach his own credentials.
It's a tough business.
It is a tough business. And then, you know, at that debate in New Hampshire, Peter Jennings asked him, you know, about Michael Moore's comment that Bush was a deserter. And, of course, someone checked into this. ABC's program, the Jennings program, had never done a story on the Bush-Awald business.
Hello.
Hello. But instead of taking that pitch and essentially knocking it into 3 weeks later, which is what we have, with this is a big issue still, Clark made some meek comment and backed away from it. You've got to be fast. And in fact, Bush himself gave an instance of this in one of his debates when someone said to him, who's your favorite political philosopher? And without hesitating, he said, Jesus. End of discussion.
Yeah, he was quick. And still, there was something noble in Wesley Clark standing up. I'm glad he did it. He opened up in a remarkable primary season. He opened up the windows. He opened up the doors even further.
Oh, he did, and a very sound man. Every time he started talking about matters military, people, you could nod your head. And but this isn't a game for first timers. General Eisenhower tried it, and once they took him to a studio, and he had to read these commercials. And at one point, he said, "To think that an old general has come to this."
Come to this. Matters military were not so much fun for George Bush this week.
No, that issue just won't go away, although the White House now apparently says they found somebody who did see him in the Alabama National Guard. The New York Times talked to 16 people in various parts of the Guard who don't remember him. This isn't going to go away. We're going to hear more about it because Kerry is the nominee. And the Republicans don't like this being raised at all. They think it's unfair, and they're trying to make it into they're really smearing the Guard.
But they're well practiced at this kind of politics themselves, and no doubt things will mud will fly in both directions before this.
Yes, there is mud gathering even as we speak, no doubt.
And then gay marriage. I mean, the courts are moving ahead. It's been put in civil rights terms, but there's still this visceral response from a not insubstantial part of the country that says, my gosh, what about nature?
Yeah, you know, I keep hearing that, and I listen on C-SPAN every morning to people calling about it, and their objection seemed to be, it says in Leviticus it's wrong. Well, of course, it says in Leviticus that eating milk with meat should get you hung. And it's tradition. It's always been this way. Well, you know, so was segregation tradition. I don't know. If the arguments just come down to that, it's almost like a fundamentalist objection. It's always been this way. It should be this way. I'm not persuaded.
But it's still very much on the agenda, not just in Massachusetts.
Oh no, we're going to hear about it from the president. And if the constitutional amendment is proposed to ban it nationally, it'll be the first time the Constitution will have ever restricted freedom for a category of persons. It was born that way with blacks, but it freed itself of that.
Well, there will be much more certainly on that theme. Jack, have a great weekend, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.